Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast, where we delve deep into the gravity-based side of mountain biking. This week, the podcast is supported by Trek Bikes, We Are One Composites and Dialed Health. You know that moment during a perfect ride when you're not thinking about back pain or worried about running out of gas? You're just flying and feeling strong and wishing more rides were like this one. What would that take? Well, Dialed Health believe that it's simple and all you need is a minimal amount of strength and mobility training. Dialed Health provides a complete set of focus programs designed to produce results on the bike, no matter what your skill level or your riding style. If you want to get a feel for what Dialed Health has to offer, then give last week's episode with their founder, Derek Teal, a listen. You'll hear him drop some awesome knowledge bombs and explain his training philosophy. It's definitely made me think about how I structure my weeks to get the most from my training. They've just launched their new website and it looks amazing. There's comprehensive videos to go with each exercise so you can make sure that you're doing things right. You can even track your progress right there on the website and there are plenty of programs to choose from so you can pick what is right for you and your goals. There's a 7-day free trial of all the programs and if you like what you see, then as a Downtime listener, you can get $30 off an annual subscription by using the code DTP30 at the checkout. That's the letters DTP followed by the number 30, all uppercase. Just head to dialedhealth.com now and give it a try. If you're a regular listener to the podcast, then you'll have heard me talk about We Are One Composites before, and you'll know that they're making incredible quality carbon wheels out in Kamloops in Canada. I currently have their Faction 29er wheels on my new bike and I'm loving them. They look great, which is always a good place to start. The quality of the finish of a carbon part is a good indicator of the quality of the part itself, and when the surfaces that you don't even really see, like the insides of the rim, have a stunning finish, then you know you've got something which has been lovingly and carefully made. The ride is incredible, you can trust them to go exactly where you point them, but they aren't so stiff that you get pinged around on the trail. If you're interested in getting your hands on some amazing We Are One carbon gear, then as a Downtime listener, you can get 15% off all stock items during September using the code GIVER15 off at the checkout. That's GIVER15OFF over at wearonecomposites.com. Head there now and check out what they have to offer. If you're enjoying the podcast, then you can help out and support what I'm doing by grabbing yourself a t-shirt over at downtimepodcast.com/shop. There's 4 designs to choose from. They're all 100% organic, made using renewable energy and shipped without any single-use plastics. Don't forget to make sure you subscribe to the show for free and get every episode as soon as it drops. While you're there, you can also join my newsletter for a weekly dose of interesting bike-related stuff, competitions and products I've been enjoying. You can do both these things at downtimepodcast.com/subscribe. This episode is also supported by Trek Bikes, and I'm joined by their Director of Mountain Bike Product Development, John Riley, and Senior Engineer, Dylan Howes, to find out all about the new Trek Slash that launched last week. We chat about how a project like this gets started, Trek's approach to benchmarking the competition, and how important their ride testing team is. We talk about what makes a good tester, and how they use that team to take the bike through its prototype stages. They explain their choices on geometry and wheel size and talk us through their new shock, which was co-developed with RockShox. If you're interested to find out more about how bikes are developed, then this is a must listen. So without further ado, here's John and Dylan. John Riley and Dylan Howes, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. John, we'll start off with you. How's things?
Not bad based on the situation that we're all in, weather's been good, so I've been able to ride the bike and get out. So far, so good.
Yeah, that helps a lot, doesn't it? Tell us a little bit then about your job title and what that means for you. What do you do at Trek?
You bet. So I am the Global Director of Mountain Bike Product Development, which is a big words for basically being a product manager. So that entails basically working with vendors, talking about their products, and then also working with engineering and ID and laying out a schedule for product development. And so I also work with pretty much market research and consumer research and bring those ideas back and kind of propose our direction for the product design and, quantities and all, the aspects of bringing that to market.
Okay. And that's across kind of XC, trail, enduro, downhill, like the whole range of mountain bike. Yeah.
Yeah, you bet. It's so with the mountain product end, everything's under kind of that one umbrella with product. And then from there, though, there are some divisions even within the product department that specialized in things like hardtails versus full suspension. But my particular role is overseeing all of that.
Got you. All right. Good stuff. And Dylan, how about you? How's things?
Not too bad. Keeping busy here. Keeping busy. Lucky to be able to keep working. Working from home, but weather's good, like Riley said, and at least been able to get out and ride quite a bit. So
that's a good thing for sure. And again, tell us a little bit about kind of your job title and what that means as to how you fit into the Trek family.
Sure. I'm one of the senior mountain bike engineers at Trek. So I'll work on a project these days from usually from beginning to end. In previous years, I've worked much more solely on the R&D side, but we've tried to mix that up lately and have more engineers work on more projects from the very start of it to the very end.
Uh-huh. So would you be kind of allocated to one project at a time until it's finished, or do you work across different things that are going on at the same time?
There's usually a little bit of overlap, but pretty much one to the end. You may very well have two projects going on at a time.
Okay.
Probably different phases of those projects.
Yeah, pretty focused on a limited amount of stuff at the same time.
Yeah, a limited amount of stuff, but I do work solely on mountain bikes. Uh-huh. But cool. I have worked on everything from hardtails to downhill. The fun ones are when you get to do something custom for somebody like Brandon Semenuk or one of our team riders.
Nice. Yeah, that's cool, man. All right. Well, before we get stuck into talking about the new Slash, you guys at Trek have got, you know, you've got quite a history with 29ers and with long travel 29ers. John, maybe tell us a little bit about what brought you to that solution kind of quite early in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, I think, you know, we have to look at the opportunity that we had with Fisher. So Fisher was a brand under the Trek umbrella for years. And Fisher really, I would say, you know, brought 29ers to the masses by convincing fork vendors and tire vendors to make products to support 29er. And then when Fisher got rolled into the Trek brand, we, of course, embraced the 29ers as well. And part of that was, you know, seeing that this had a really unique opportunity to kind of change how riders experience the trail. So we really thought it offered a lot of benefits, but there was a lot of challenges. The first challenge was vendors, and that was convincing tire vendors and fork vendors to make products that we needed for the bike. So we got over that hurdle. And then we started expanding. At first, it was a cross-country only product, so it was looked at as a race bike. You know, that was pretty much how 29ers were perceived at first. And then we started looking at how 29ers could expand into longer travel bikes. And our first foray into that was called the Remedy 29. And that bike was just at the same time that the EWS series started, and we had a team with Tracy Mosley on it and Justin, and we were able to convince Tracy to race that Remedy 29er at the very first EWS. And when I say convince her, we did not tell her she had to, but we sent it to her and asked her to test it back to back with the 26 inch bike that she had, and she agreed that it felt faster to her, and she raced it and won. So that was the start of us kind of looking more at 29ers across the board and not just as cross-country products.
Yeah, and you've been able to make it work even at the smaller sizes, I think, which is something that people were maybe quite skeptical about early on. So, I mean, Katie Winton is one of your Enduro factory riders, is pretty short, and she's loving the 29er. So yeah, it's impressive that you've managed to get it down to that size. A lot of challenge in that, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, the challenges kind of lined up one by one, and we had to take them on. The vendor one was the first one. Then basically handling was the second. So there, they got a reputation as being slow handling. And so we actually went to a different offset on the fork as a way to solve that. So that, again, went against kind of the norm in the industry. And we definitely took some slings and arrows for coming up with a different standard. But we found that that really opened people's eyes to the fact that 29ers were not slow handling if the geometry was done right. And then the sizing was another one, standover and full suspension and 29ers. When you add those two things together, there's a lot of complexity in trying to make a bike that has good standover. And it took time, because at first we were looking at 27.5 in the smaller sizes to allow the standover to work properly. But over time, we were able to figure out how to get everything packaged in a way where standover would be acceptable. And even now, our race bikes and all of our bikes are moving to all just 29ers. Originally, we had a concept of fit for really small riders of using 27.5 because of the challenges, but we've been able to overcome those even on the cross country end.
Yeah, impressive stuff. So yeah, we're here to talk about the new Slash, which is as very recently launched. So give us a little bit of insight into how a project like that gets started. You mentioned earlier that you work a lot with the kind of the marketing teams and the market research people. How do you go about setting up a project like this and working out who your target customer is, what your aims are, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, for sure. It's a complex mix of things, but a lot of times in a project like this, it's taking the current project that we have in market. So we already had a Slash and we were very happy with that bike when we launched it, and it's done very well. But as things in our industry progress, geometries, tire sizes, all those things, we need to adapt and we need to take that bike and make sure that it's following the trends and are, you know, hopefully exceeding expectations so that it will be a popular bike for years to come. And honestly, it starts as soon as the first bike that we introduced delivers. We never usually get everything we want on a bike when it goes to market. There's a certain point in our process where we have to say stop. And I have to stop people like Dylan, who has about 1,000 different ideas in his head of things that would be cool for that rider in that category, and say, okay, this is it. We have to lock it down. This is the time when we have to say, what can we get done and hit this production date? And from that point on, we start the next bike. So literally, we've been working on this bike for almost 2 years.
Impressive stuff. And what kind of input do you get then to the early phase of the project? Obviously, you've got, I guess, ideas that spill over from the previous Slash. You've got new ideas that your team's coming up with. What other input comes into the start of the project?
Yeah, with this one in particular, it does start with the team. So we do with the Enduro team. You know, our goal there is to allow them to have the best tool for the job. We want them to be successful and confident that they've got a fast bike to ride. So a lot of it is with the team, just trying to kind of figure the extreme end of the category, because they're pushing the bike at a very high level. And some of those things apply for, you know, the general customer, some don't. And so we have to kind of weed through what is needed for racing and what would be good for this kind of enduro trail rider that's also a big part of the business for this bike. And so from there, we kind of start with the team, test some things, and then we start doing a test with our internal groups. And one thing that we have that I am pretty proud of is a pretty substantial test system in place with riders across the US and in Europe as well. And we basically, they are managed by Travis Brown, who's a former pro rider for us that's retired and now lives in Durango, Colorado, and manages about 40 to 50 riders that get samples of the bikes in different iterations to give us feedback on the bikes. So we'll test geometries, we'll test a head tube angle, we'll test a reach, and we'll fabricate those in aluminum and we'll send them out to our test riders to give us feedback on that and if it's going the right direction or not. And then we'll get to a point where we'll make a full proto and we'll send them out for evaluation. And then that's where we kind of lock again the decision point of what features will go forward and what won't.
Got you. Okay. Before you start getting into that prototyping phase, do you do much benchmarking of competition?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the thing that's interesting about the bike industry is just how I think all the companies push each other. There's a lot of good things out there that, you know, we'll see and go, well, that's not a bad way to look at it. And we'll take a look at what they're doing. We kind of have our spin on the way we think bikes should handle and the way bikes should work. But that doesn't mean that we can't learn from some of the things that we've seen out there as other companies are pushing longer travel, 29. You know, there's a lot to be learned, you know, out there. So that's definitely part of it is benchmarking, not just the product, but also just how it's, you know, being perceived in the marketplace as well. It could be colors, it could be graphics, it could be a lot of different things that we'll look at to just see, you know, what's working and what's not working.
You've got so much to look at in what your competition's doing, like you said, you know, even down to color and all of this kind of stuff. But when it comes to riding the bike, who are the people that are, you know, actually swinging a leg over the competitors' bikes and feeding back to the team?
Yeah, for sure. We have that process in place as well, because with benchmarking, you need to do kind of back to back so that you can see what we have versus that product and evaluate it. You know, what's good, what's bad, what do we like, what we don't like. So that comes down to some internal testers. It would be myself. It would be the engineer like Dylan, in this case with the Slash. And then it would be two of our key testers. And that would be Andrew Shandro, that he is kind of our enduro downhill tester. So former pro rider, camp rider, C3 rider. I think personally, probably one of the best testers I've ever worked with in long travel bikes. So he's key. So he'll test the competitor bike versus our bike. And then Travis Brown will also do that as well. So those are kind of the internal group that will do the benchmarking.
Yeah. And what makes a good tester then?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I can't really give you like the five things that make a great tester. It's really a combination of a lot of things. And I can tell you that most racers that I work with think that they are good testers, but I've found that's not really the case. To ride a bike fast is definitely a talent that's pretty unique and special for sure. But being able to communicate to engineering and product what exactly you like and don't like is an art. It really is. It's not something that I find as a common trait in people that ride, even at a high level. We've been really lucky to have Shandro and Travis Brown. And I would say we've internally got a very good group of engineers that ride at a high level that are very keen on finding the differences between our bikes and competitors' bikes. And we're always looking for more. We've had riders in Europe as well. Tracy Mosley is a great tester. She gives tremendous feedback on the enduro downhill race product, including EX and e-bikes now as well. So we, you know, now it's expanded into e-bikes because that's such a big part of our business. So most of our testers for e-bikes are in Europe, because there the market is the largest and the most complex. And so we have riders over there that do nothing but that ride e-bikes for us. And some of them are competitors and some of them aren't. But it's an interesting challenge to find people that have the right balance.
Yeah, it's a tricky job for sure. Dylan,
I think if I could jump in, I would say an important characteristic is just being able to break down just what's happening. To be able to say, over a high speed bump or over that square edge bump in the trail, I was feeling this. and the other bike did that. Or I want this bike to feel just a little bit more here. And I think what we have with our team is definitely a big variation in riders. So we'll go out and do, well, we used to when we could travel. We do a big test session with six people, like John says, product, engineers, our testers. And you'll start off with a couple of days of short back-to-back laps. And you're comparing one bike to the next or one setting to the next. But what we also have with that group is different people will pick up different things. And so then you can start to piece it together. And then also as the engineer or the person involved in the testing, not only doing the testing, but taking that feedback, you learn to interpret, okay, when Andrew says this, this is kind of what he's feeling. So it's a buildup of years of doing it together, but it's an ability to really break down what's happening on the bike and what it's doing.
Yeah. And do you find that as well as, you know, a variety of riders helping get a more rich feedback on the bikes, does it also mean you often get, you know, not everyone wants the same thing out of a bike? And how do you take different points of view and different perspectives and then decide what you think the right solution is?
That's a good question, because we face that a lot, and especially on a bike like this, where what a top level EWS racer wants is not necessarily what that even high level trail rider wants or needs. And there you're trying to balance out those characteristics, and you're trying to come to the best the best blend of those things. On occasion, you might go, well, the purpose of this bike is to be this, so we're going to skew it towards that pro rider. A lot of the times what we try to do is build in a very good baseline design, like the leverage rate on the bike, for instance, how that link activates the shock. Mm-hmm. We work very hard on that in the initial stages to get it just right, to do just what we want. And then you've got a good baseline that you can tune up or down in the shock, so that you can meet the needs of both that pro rider and the trail rider by going, okay, we set the shock up this way for this person, this way for that person. You can even make those recommendations as part of the setup guide to the bike. It comes down to balancing out those characteristics and having a good baseline that you can both tune up and down. We've seen bikes where they've got something that works well, but you can only tune it one direction from there, say.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So for this, the prototype stage of this project in particular, how long did that go on for? And what were the key attributes or key elements of the bike that you were looking to tune through that prototype phase?
This one was... I don't remember how many months. I know we went through two rounds of prototypes on the bike, building them. A lot of input came from the team, the race team, on what they were looking for, things they wanted. The initial phase was looking at some of the geometry and some of the travel and figuring out how much more travel do we want? Do we want more travel? So we had a bike set up that mimicked where we wanted to go. There were some subtle changes made to pivot locations, to leverage rates. And then it was a lot of back-to-back testing going, is more travel better? There's a certain point where more travel doesn't necessarily make the bike better. It makes it better downhill, but not all around.
Yeah.
On this bike, we did that, and we found there wasn't any drawback to going more travel. It was just better.
Okay.
And then from there, it was doing the next round, going, okay, we've figured that out. Let's start making these geometry changes, which included the much longer length than we'd started with. I think these days, every bike gets a bit longer, a bit slacker, and our first prototypes were that. And the next one was looking at going, well, what if we push those limits? Let's go really long on the bike and see where it ends up. And again, that was tested over a couple of test sessions, different locations, different riders, and sort of proved it out and went, yeah, we're really happy with these changes. This extra length is good. There's no downside to it. It's just better. It's just faster. And you're grading that on uphill, downhill, all around use. Mm-hmm. And even some early prototype testing with the EWS team. We got a few runs with them on the bike, just going, yep, this is headed in the right direction. Some of that can get hard because they've got a highly tuned carbon bike that they're very familiar with.
Yeah.
And then you come to a test session with an alloy prototype mule that's working well, but just feels a little different to them. And that's where it like John says, you want to make sure that this bike is still working for the racers. You're not necessarily looking for some of that fine input on, yeah, the compression is doing this or it's doing this over the bump. You're making sure the geometry still works, that they can still go fast, they can still climb comfortably. Mm-hmm. But it can get hard when they're going to a heavier alloy mule versus their lightweight carbon race bike.
Yeah, for sure. With things like the geometry, so we talk about the length in particular. So this bike's a decent chunk longer than the previous Slash. How far did you go with that? Have you tested even longer versions than the bike that you've launched and then sort of come back to what you feel is an optimum? How have you found what you think is the perfect solution at this point in time?
I think we drew on a lot of other bikes that we had. We drew on development from the downhill stuff. In this case, some of the length drew on work we'd done on the full suspension Stash bike from a year or two earlier. So in this case, we did push it much longer than we'd been before. And we found we were happy. That's probably a case of, like John says, where we would have done that, been happy, and I would have been happy to go, all right, let's do another one and go even longer and see if it's too long. Mm-hmm. And that's where you have to cut it off and go, no, we'll never get to the finish line if we keep making changes, keep iterating. But this one was considerably longer, and it was a case of going, yeah, this might be too long, but let's try it. Would we try even longer? Maybe in another project. I think we've done that also in the past, pushing length, and had found what we thought were limits, at least for the time, because currently we're going through another shift in bike design, I think, just steeper angles, longer and longer front ends, and finding they still work for us, where previously we would have looked at it and gone, you'll never get that around a corner, or it'll take all day to get it back uphill.
Yeah.
Trail design changes, and bike design and trail design both influence each other back and forth. So I think we are always trying that. The tough part does come in at some point. You have to say, yep, this is really good. We're happy with this right now. We have to go to get to production.
For sure, yeah. And you've lengthened the rear end a bit on the new version as well, yeah? Can you talk a little bit about why that's a good thing?
The biggest one is keeping the balance. As if you just spread out the front end, you're you're shifting that waist bias more and more rearward. Now, granted, we've steepened the seat tube considerably, so that cockpit from saddle to bars is still about the same as it's always been, and that's kind of a physiology thing where a certain size rider simply only has so far to reach.
Yeah.
But once you stand up on the bike and take the saddle out of it, then you are back to that, your weight's on the pedals and it's distributed between these two wheels. So as you keep lengthening the front end, you need to add a little bit to the back end just to spread it out and keep your weight balance about where you want it.
Mm-hmm.
Or at a point where it's not getting so long that it's great and stable downhill, but you get to a corner and now your weight balance is so rearward biased, you have no front traction and you slide out in a corner. So yeah. you're playing with those numbers a little bit. I think we've had much longer chain stays on the rear end of bikes in the past. The Remedy 29 was quite a bit longer, which was longer for other reasons at the time based on tire clearance, the cranks and chain lines we could work around. There was a trend there to go shorter and it worked well on bikes, so we kept using that works well. This was a case of copying a little bit of what we'd done on the Fuel EX, of pulling it back just a little bit, adding a bit more tire clearance, getting clearance at that chainstay area. And by that, I mean the area in between the tire and the chain ring,
mm-hmm.
which gets to be a very tight area to design around. So anytime we can get a bit more room there to create a good cross-section of tubing through there, make sure the bike's strong enough, stiff enough, we've got room for cables. But really the length is dictated by the front end a bit and just trying to keep that weight balance on the bike.
Okay, got you. And I guess one of the sort of hot topics over the last maybe 18 months now is mixed wheel size bikes. And there's been a lot of talk of mullets and a number of brands launching mullet bikes and some success in both EWS and World Cup Downhill of mixed wheel size bikes. Was it ever a consideration for the new Slash? Did you try it? What were your thoughts on it? And how have you ended up at the full 29er being the right answer for you?
Probably the biggest part of that was team demand. They were happy with the 29er. They were not looking for anything different out of the back end. We felt the balanced wheel size keeps the keeps the wheels rolling over the bumps in the same manner, being the same large diameter. But really, this bike was focused as the ultimate enduro race bike, and the dual 29er wheel size was the fastest combo, and there wasn't any other design need for the smaller wheel, and so this one just stayed a focused, dedicated 29er.
Mm-hmm. And you said earlier, you've got smaller riders on the team who seem to be making that 29er work and not complaining about buzzing their ass on the back tire all the time. So I guess,
right.
Yeah, however you've managed to package this thing, it seems to be working. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I think so. It was, for us, it was a lack of a need to go to a mullet, and the team riders simply weren't asking for it.
Yeah. Was that packaging on the rear end any more of a challenge now that you've gone, because I think you were 150 mil on the previous version and you're 160 mil rear end travel now. Does that make things any harder? Because with the more wheel travel, maybe the wheel is getting closer to the rider.
Yeah. The wheel gets closer to the rider. That was something that the additional closeness to the rider wasn't really the issue. And with all of our testing, that wasn't something that comes up. The design part of the packaging gets harder because you've got more wheel travel, that wheel's coming up further. We want more and more seat post insertion. So you've got to move shocks around, seat tubes around to get that. Mm-hmm. And then a very important consideration is that we definitely want a water bottle inside the main front triangle.
Yeah.
And so then you've got to place that, make sure it works with all these bigger and bigger shocks, piggyback shocks, and still keep the standover low, especially on the smaller sizes. So that's where the packaging gets harder. And a lot of that is what drove the layout on the new bike, of tucking that shock down low, which caused some other design challenges, especially on the alloy bike, of just getting those tubes shaped, formed, being able to fit the shock in there. But that was those were kind of the places everything had to move to get those shock clearance, seat post insertion, wheel clearance, standover, and a water bottle.
Yeah, and the seat post insertion is so you can get the longest drop post possible in each frame size, I guess.
Yeah.
Got you. So were there any sort of compromises that you feel you had to make in that overall package solution then? Because it's very rare to get everything to be an optimum, right?
I think for this bike, we did get a very good layout. I think we... At this point, I don't think we had to make any compromises. The compromises came in the forming of the tubes, the shaping of the mainframe. As you see it, there's a lot of dips and indents on the tubes, both carbon and alloy. So those were the ones that kind of became the compromise. Like, okay, this is going to be harder, more expensive, going to take more work, but those were ones luckily we could make. We figured out how to do it with a reasonable cost. And just be able to get there with the finished product.
Yeah. Impressive. Well, let's talk a little bit about suspension and specifically the rear shock on the bike. Cause I think you've done quite a lot of work in that area and it seems to be focused around making it maybe easier to set up, more user-friendly for the rider. Who's best out of the two of you to talk a bit about the rear suspension on the bike?
Riley, you might want to take some of that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I can talk about some of the basics with it. We have a full R&D suspension guru in Jose Gonzalez that could get into all the shim stack and thing, you know, that kind of detail. But the shock itself follows kind of the same thought process that we've had for many years now, which is where we want to develop the kinematics of the frame along with the shock. And it's really hard as a company to kind of wait and see what companies have coming available that will work with your bike. It's better to have that figured out while you're developing the bike. So a lot of what we do is to try and match what we're trying to do with the overall bike package. So this particular shock was a collaboration with RockShox and bringing together some of the new things that they were bringing out in their suspension and working as well with some of our technologies that we had. In particular, this was thru-shaft that we wanted to use. And that was mostly because we found it kind of amplified the benefit of the kind of new design that RockShox had to optimize kind of that, what we like to call like a almost a bottomless feel to the suspension, so that when you're riding the bike, you're going over really rough terrain. It doesn't feel like you're ever getting through the travel completely. It just always feels like it's active. So that was the goal initially: match the kinetics with the shock, optimize the bike, get the best performance you can between both. And then within that, we know that there's a lot of struggles for riders in setup. And even though everybody has a really good website you can go to and get information, including Trek, we we still wanted to make it simpler. So we've been pushing really hard for all the suspension vendors to go to numeric indicators on their adjustments. So that way, you know, by a number where you are, not by clicks on or off or open or closed. Those things always get confusing for a rider, I think, that's not super dialed on suspension. So the idea now is you could go to the Trek website, put in your body weight and your height and some other information, and it'll give you a starting PSI and a number for the rebound. So it just takes one more element of the setup in a more simplified way. And that's what we were looking to do. And we're pushing all of our vendors to do that. We just want to make setup simple because we realize that if the bike isn't set up well, you're not going to get the performance of the bike. You're going to miss it. But if you dial it in, you're going to get an awesome experience. So anything we can do to make that simpler is what we're pushing for.
So you've got an adjuster for the compression side of the shock as well, which is kind of, that's quite new. I think I've not seen that anywhere else before.
Yeah, it's really cool. The kind of the batwing configuration where you can change, you know, either plus or minus on the compression is really cool in that it works really well. So sometimes when you get those adjustments, those small tune adjustments, they're really good for like a pro rider or for someone that's really keen on the suspension. But what's really nice about this design that RockShox came up with is those little pieces are the final touch in kind of making the bike work the best for where you are, what your terrain is. And they're real simple to do. I think in the past, a lot of times the compression adjustments are where some of the complexities come in for setting the bike up, that if you don't do it right, you can actually make a suspension perform poorly. So, you know, that's kind of where I think this is a really nice, tight, easy feature to be able to use.
Yeah. So this is working on just the low speed compression. So effectively the body input into the bike rather than the terrain input into the bike. And it's got like a plus, correct, a minus, and a middle position. Can you talk us just a little bit about kind of how you might use that? Like what might lead you to switch between the center position or the plus and the minus?
Yeah, I think that goes back to that baseline setting. So the way the shock is sort of set up, that standard middle position, that's intended as the all-around position. And if you just put it there and left it there, the bike would be great just about everywhere. It's giving you that, again, that ability to adjust up or down from there. So say you were on a very long ride or even a very varied ride. You might be traversing different kinds of terrain. Your standard settings where you're going to be, you get into that sort of that flowy park type situation, a big flowy, bermy jump trail. There you'd probably put it into the plus side, just add a little bit more support at the expense of some of that small bump, but you're trying to hold it up for jumps, for berms, for cornering, for smoother terrain, perhaps a bit of more efficient pedaling if you needed it right there. And you get out of that section, hit the chunky, rocky downhill, you put it in the minus one just to open it up that little bit more. And so it's just giving you a bit of freedom to really dial in the ride in a way that you couldn't get with any other form of control. There's a lot of people that try to build in more and more anti-squat into a bike to go, well, now it's pedals more efficiently. Well, that works, but you can't tune it back the other way when you need it to open up more. Something like, I'm thinking some of our former test locations in Arizona, where you've got these very stair-steppy, loose climbs. That might also be a position where you'd put it in the open, because you want that bike to stay efficient, or sorry, not the open, the minus position, because it'll let that wheel just move up over those stair square-edged bumps as you're climbing to maintain traction and allow the bike to stay more level and have the wheel move underneath it over the bumps. So it's giving you that immediate, easy, quick control to just tune it for that trail condition.
Yeah, helps you, I guess, get the bike in a kind of more optimal setup more of the time, maybe.
Yeah, more optimal setup more of the time, and just the ability to very quickly change it without resetting up the shock just for those immediate changing trail conditions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fair play. And am I right in thinking you guys have done some work in reducing the stiction on the shock as well, or rock shocks, and you guys together?
Yeah, that's been a big focus of us. Reason for using bearings and more of the shock mounting points. I think everybody's doing that. RockShox and Fox as well, that's been a major focus for them, just refining how they manufacture the parts, trying to up the level of smoothness on those anodized sliding parts, better and better seals, different weight oils, more chemistry in the oil itself to add more lubricating elements to the oil, which gets into a whole oil science I'm no expert at. But it is those little subtle things that they're doing just to try to keep it moving better and better that continually creates a better product.
Yeah, gives you that more, even more sort of small bump sensitivity.
Yeah, and it's not trying to reinvent the wheel. It's not trying to say, oh, the old fork's outdated. The old fork still works great. It's just when you do want a new one, or you do come to buy a new one, this new one's going to work even better.
Yeah, good stuff. Let's talk a little bit about storage, because it's becoming more and more of a hot topic. Like you said, you've been very keen to make sure you can fit a water bottle in all of the frame sizes. People are definitely ditching packs where they can. John, maybe start with you. Tell us a little bit about how you've approached storage on the new Slash.
Yeah, that's a great one. We've been a fan of storage in the frame in different types and ways for a while. And, it's a lot more challenging than you think to be able to kind of balance the feature over the performance, meaning, when you're cutting holes in a frame, you're affecting the performance of the frame. You have to, equal that somewhere else, whether it's the layup or in the, in the case of the aluminum bike, it's, the welds and other things. So we introduced storage last year on the EX, but only on the carbon bike. And the reason was that, believe it or not, aluminum was way more challenging to figure out all those balances than the carbon was. Because with carbon, you have layups and things you can do in the actual laminates of the material. With aluminum, all you really have is welding. And the welding can get very heavy and can also affect stiffness and it's basically the performance of the overall frame. So it took us much longer to figure out storage on aluminum than it did on carbon, but we finally mastered it to a point where we were really happy and have introduced it on this for the first time. So for the first time for us, we now have carbon and aluminum bikes with storage. So even if you buy the entry-level bike, you get storage. And I think everybody's kind of going that direction of wanting storage because it just frees you up to have a nice experience without a pack, without having things on your shoulders or your hips while you're riding. So you can have your emergency kit or you can have your snacks in there, whatever your preference is, without having to strap it onto the frame with straps and bungees and other things. But we also believe even, at this level, a water bottle is needed, even though you know, when you're on a big mission of a ride, you might tend to have a hydration pack of some type because of clothing and other things. But just generally going out for a rip after work or on the weekends, it's kind of nice to just grab the bike and go. And that's what storage enables you.
Yeah. So what tweaks did you have to make on the aluminium version then to actually make it work with the storage on board?
You know, a lot of it had to do with the weld configuration on the tube. So the thing that happens with aluminum and welding is that, you know, you affect the frame every time you're welding. And if the weld is in a certain area, you're pulling in that direction potentially, and you have to offset that. It really was an interesting challenge, just keeping the tube, you know, first off internally clear so you could have storage inside, and then externally making so you had a door that's the same as the carbon, so not a different, unique system. And at the same time, hitting the stiffness parameters that we have for full frame flex, and not making the frame extremely heavy at the same time. Because you can always add a feature if one of the parameters is it doesn't matter how much it weighs. But all of our bikes, one of our kind of cornerstones of design is trying to make the bike as light as we can for the category. And even in aluminum, we have weight parameters that we try to hit to keep our bikes fun and easy to ride for somebody, because a light bike is always more fun than a heavier bike.
Yeah, I was going to ask you a little bit about how important you thought weight was in bikes. And I guess you've kind of answered that to some extent, but adding things like storage, longer seat posts, all of this that's weight, right? So how do you get to where you want to be with that?
Well, it's a challenge for sure that we, you know, put up to engineering, like Dylan, and have them kind of work through the problem and see if there's some solution. So as an example, in the carbon frame, it was pretty straightforward with layup, but then cable management, clean down tube, you know, making sure there wasn't any sharp surfaces inside the tube, all that was kind of the final details. But we were able to do that with about a 200 gram hit to the frame. So that was pretty well balanced to get that much of a feature for 200 grams. Mm-hmm. That's about what it took to get there by adding layup to the frame to keep the stiffness and everything the same. It was a little more on aluminum. There it started creeping up to more like 300 grams of additional weight. But again, with aluminum, you can do some things with the forming and shaping of the tubes to also keep the weight down. So, you know, it did affect the overall weight of the fuselage, but not in an amount that made it uncompetitive. And that's where we get into benchmarking. So we do benchmark weights, and we want to make sure that we're not exceeding what we find as the average benchmark for that category. And we didn't with that bike.
Okay, good stuff. Dylan, let's talk a little bit about testing. We've talked about ride testing and working with people like Andrew Shandro and those guys to kind of get where you want to be. But what about the non-riding testing, the lab-based testing? What sort of stuff does the bike get put through?
It gets put through our full battery of tests that basically every product has to go through. There are a bunch of tests you have to pass legally just to sell a product. But what we've found over the years is that a top level rider, you know, even an aggressive amateur trail rider can quickly exceed those limits. So we've developed a lot of our own tests over the years. And these run the gamut from basic strength tests. There's a one we call reverse energy, which is basically simulating a massive case on a jump. And there you're holding the bike from the rear axle and from the front axle on a big fork fixture and pulling down on the bottom bracket till the frame buckles. You've got fatigue tests, which would be like your pedaling type ones, repeatedly loading the saddle, repeatedly loading the front end as though you're running over square edge bumps all day long. So you've got all those, and it's the fatigue ones are often the ones that more and more of the problems start showing up, because it's easy to keep adding material to get the basic strength. The fatigue one is where a little crack might start from just a repeated twisting pedaling load. And that was an example of something that took quite a bit of work on the aluminum storage. You know, it was very focused on the exact shape of that cutout in the tube for where the door bolts in, and even down to how we put in the holes to bolt in the frame that the door attaches to. In the carbon, we could put in these little oval holes that held a captured nut, and you add a few more layers of carbon or strips of carbon around there, and you're in good shape. On the alloy, even with thickening up the tube, those holes over repeated fatigue twisting loads kept forming a little crack. So it was iterating again and going, okay, how do we do this? Okay, the crack went here. Let's change the design. And then you chase it somewhere else and you do it again. And it was something that almost killed the storage on the alloy project. And the last go round, another engineer who was working on the alloy bike, he finally figured out the way of, like, well, let's try this whole shape this way with this one and this exact radius in this corner, and got it to pass. But that's it's an extensive, long process, because you have to build the bikes, test them through the lab, and then as a change comes, it's go back, make that change, build more frames, test them again. So it's very extensive. And then that's not even getting into all the stiffness tests we do to make sure it's the right stiffness, it's stiff enough, it's not too stiff, that the ride quality is still there.
And do you look to balance the aluminium and the carbon from a frame stiffness perspective?
We've tried to over the years. There's a minimum stiffness that we know we want to get. There's also a maximum stiffness where the bike can just get too jarring. So we try to balance that as best we can. In the end, there are simply differences in the material, in the way, say, aluminium versus carbon is going to rebound from being twisted, that created a different trail feel and a different dynamic stiffness. And that's something that at some point you go, well, these are simply the differences in the material. And that's part of what you're paying for with the carbon, is the weight and this different ride quality. We have also found cases where a rider goes, no, I prefer the feel of this aluminum bike. And that's why we've got sort of those higher spec alloy bikes in the range for that rider that just wants the alloy bike, that likes the feel. So there's a goal of balance. There's a reality of a slightly different ride feel in the end anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting stuff. So Dylan, from your side of things, what do you feel was the most challenging part of the project and why?
From the beginning, probably the packaging on this one was the biggest challenge, and trying to make sure that we could fit all those elements in that we wanted, which was more travel, good tire clearance, longer seat post insertion, bigger shocks, basically trying to make sure we could fit just about any shock you could want to put in there, whether we were going to spec it or not. Have that water bottle, have the storage, and the standover. And that took a lot of tries and iterating, and some of the ideas we'd come up with early on, it did drastically change the look of the bike. And even though it would have functioned the same way, at least from a suspension, a kinematics point of view, it made the bike look too different. And so it was like that. It doesn't look like a Trek anymore. And it's just not, it yeah. wasn't right for us. And so that's why I was like, okay, keep trying. Can we tuck it in here? Can we tuck it in there? What can we pull? Can we put the shock through some tube, insert it somewhere, pierce a tube? And eventually we struck on the layout we did come up with that, like I said, had its own tube shaping challenges. But that was probably the hardest yeah. one. The alloy storage okay. certainly was probably equally as big in the number of iterations it took, getting it just right.
Yeah. What about from your side of things, John? Do you, because you obviously you look at this from a slightly different perspective, I guess, in your role. Would you agree with those challenges, or were there other elements that you saw from your side?
Well, I think the storage one that Dylan hit on is the one that was the biggest challenge. So when we launched the EX last year, we had aluminum storage on that project list. And as I was saying earlier, that there's a time where you just have to say, okay, now's the day. We're moving forward with what we can. And we did not have the alloy storage done. It just wasn't passing testing. It wasn't working in any of the weight parameters. So we said, okay, let's not stop working on alloy storage. Let's keep working on it, but we'll wait for the next project to bring it in to market. And that's where it became part of the Slash project. So it's, you know, interesting because immediately the question is, well, why didn't you do it on the EX? Well, it just wasn't ready at that time because of all this testing that we had to do. And I think the one thing I just wanted to add to Dylan's comment on testing is, and as I was saying earlier, you know, one of the benchmarks of Trek, one of kind of the pillars of design is testing. I think if you buy a Trek, you can be assured that we have done as much testing as possible on that frame to make sure that the experience that the rider has is a good one. And I'm not saying we're perfect at it, but I just know that we spend a lot of time and energy exceeding all test requirements by all countries to make sure that the experience is a good one and there's limited warranty and so forth. Again, we're not perfect, but we try to just come out with something that we know has been looked at from every angle as best as possible. Yeah. But I'd say storage from there. And then, you know, just the lineup itself, how many models, you know, do you need in this category? And then, you know, for me, it was also little things like we have full-size guards on the down tube that are removable that I think is pretty cool. You can leave them on or take them off. So there's a lot of really cool little details that I'm proud of that we pulled off on this bike that I think just make it just that much more fun when somebody buys it, you know, to have these little things that are well thought out.
Definitely, for sure. And what's the reaction been like then so far from the people that have had the chance to ride it? I guess the team, your internal testers, and maybe at this point some kind of media feedback and yeah, whoever else has had the chance to swing their leg over one.
Yeah, I mean, we were pretty excited, especially, well, team was the first that was able to get on to the bike. And, you know, before the situation that we're in now with the pandemic, we were challenged on what bike they would have when. So the team was introduced to the bike. They were like, that's it. That's the one. But then we were almost going to have to say, well, you've got to ride the old bike for the beginning of the year until the new bike is ready. And so we were going to have basically the first few races were going to be on the old Slash. And then this coming race would be where they would be riding the new bike. And now with the new situation, they're able to ride it. And they're very happy about that, because when you show a racer something new and exciting and then say, well, you can't use it yet, it's very disappointing for them.
I bet.
So that was the team was the first one, and that was our, we wanted to make sure that they came away with a bike that they thought was a big advantage for them, you know, going forward. And the media response has been similar. One of the best quotes that I've heard so far from the testing is, there's a lot of companies claiming they're making a race bike in this category, but this really is one. Right. So I was happy to hear that the sensation of speed is what I keep hearing as a comment, that the ability to go faster, almost beyond your comfort level, is easy to do on this bike. And I know some people might think that's kind of scary, but on the other hand, for this level of rider, we want it to be something that they can push and feel like they can go further in this bike than they have on a previous bike they've owned.
Good stuff. Yeah, well, if you're getting feedback like that, it sounds like you've succeeded in what you wanted to achieve.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm happy, you know, I'm always nervously happy, because, you know, before it gets out to the masses, it's, you know, only a sample of the feedback. The best feedback is customers sending in notes or commenting on forums and, you know, hearing from everybody across the spectrum who buys the bike, whether they buy a slash 7 or they buy a slash 99. We want them to all have a great experience. So right now it's on the top end level, best equipment, best bike, you know, best wheels and best tires. But for me, when I get feedback that somebody that bought a slash 7, you know, is just super stoked that they've had the best experience they've ever had on a bike in that level, that's just, for me, just as exciting. And that's what I'd love to hear about as much as I do from the team. So I'm waiting now. I'm kind of anxiously waiting to get them out into the market and getting the feedback across the board, and hoping and fingers crossed that everybody's excited and as stoked as we are about the bike.
Excellent. Well, if people want to find out a bit more about the bike, where's the best place for them to head?
For sure, it's the trekbikes.com website. We've got a pretty comprehensive amount of information there that will detail all the new upgrades, the features, and all the price points and colors. And another thing I think that I'm very proud of is that, you know, we have two different colors on every price point. And you can also go crazy in Project One to make the, you know, craziest looking bike you want, or change the spec around. So trekbikes.com is where you can kind of get started with all that stuff.
Good stuff. All right. Well, while we've got you guys on the call, it'd be interesting to just hear your advice on, you know, how would you recommend people approach getting a job in the bike industry if that's something that they're interested in, and maybe even specifically how to work for a company like Trek. And we'll start with you, John.
Well, first off, we are hiring. So, you know, the bike industry right now, luckily, is having a boom in sales globally. And we're always looking for good candidates, specifically in the mountain bike segment. Let's say your passion is for mountain biking and you're an engineer. You know, I think it really comes down to how you, I guess, talk about your passion relative to how it would work with engineering and your skill set. And a lot of it really has to do with timing. You know, if there's an opportunity and an opening, you know, a lot of times it can just be that you are passionate and driven and a good quality engineer. From the product end, just in particular in our company, most of the product positions have come up through sales, believe it or not.
Okay.
A lot of the people then our department, including myself, I was an outside rep for Trek for 8 years before I came in, and now I've been 22 years as a mountain bike product manager. Same with the vice president of the bicycle division, was also an outside rep for 6 or 7 years. David Knopf, who is the product manager for full suspension, was an inside tech rep for Trek before that. And Chris Drews, who was a product manager for the hardtail product line, was in the forecasting group. So in product, it seems like most of the positions have come up through the company. And then the engineering and industrial design, as an example, industrial design, one of the best industrial designers in our company came from Kohler, which makes toilets. And he was very passionate about biking, a very, very qualified industrial designer, and presented himself as a passionate rider looking to make a change and make a difference in the bike world. And he has turned out to be one of our best industrial designers because he's looking not just at bicycles, but at the whole industries that are out there in trends and bringing that to the market. And Ben Fullerton, again, came from Kohler and has been one of the best hires that we've ever had. So I would just say follow your passion and don't follow your wallet. Yeah. You're probably not going to make as much in the bike industry as you would in maybe the toilet industry like Kohler. If you're following your passion, I've always said, you know, you'll never work a day in your life. So it's got to be passion driven is my advice.
All right. Good stuff. What about you, Dylan? What advice would you give to people?
I think it's probably similar to any other job you might chase. As John said, you've got to want to do this for passion because this is a job you really want. If you go work in the tech industry, something else, yeah, you could probably get a much bigger paycheck doing something else. But if you are a dedicated cyclist, for me, being a dedicated mountain biker, I don't think you could pay me enough to want to go do something else. The biggest one is especially, say you're going into the technical side of bicycle design, that's going to be either an engineer or an industrial designer. You have to start off with the right basic qualifications, which these days is going to mean either an engineering degree or an industrial design degree. And then it's just pouring yourself into that, becoming the best engineer designer you can be, whether it's bicycles or not, and then start applying. I think, like any job, communication skills are key to this. You've got to be the right person for the job, somebody that fits in with the culture of that company. Bring a sense of dedication, hard work, and creativity to it.
All right. Good advice. Well, thanks a lot for your time today, chaps. It's been super interesting finding out a bit about the process and what you guys go through when you're developing a new bike, and particularly to find out more about the new Slash. And yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it out on the trails, and I hope people are enjoying riding it in the very near future.
Thanks.
Chris, thanks for having us. It's really, really a pleasure for you to allow us on, and had some great questions for us, and hope everybody enjoys it, and hope to maybe do this again with you some other time.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Take care.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
Take care.
All right, that's it for this episode with John and Dylan. I hope you've enjoyed listening and finding out more about the new Trek Slash. A massive thanks to We Are One Composites for supporting this episode of the podcast. Don't forget to head to wearonecomposites.com and check out what they have to offer. And as a downtime listener, you can use the code GIVER15 off for 15% off during September. Also, a massive thanks to Dialed Health. If you're looking to get fitter, faster, and stronger on the bike, then they have the resources that you need to make that happen as efficiently as possible. Don't forget to make the most of their 7-day free trial and give their programs a go over at dialedhealth.com. As a downtime listener, if you like what you see, then you can get $30 off an annual package by using the code DTP30 at the checkout. If you've been intrigued by the episode and you want to find out more about the new Trek Slash, then you can do that over at trekbikes.com. All the links you need are in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. If you fancy a new t-shirt, then head over to downtimepodcast.com/shop, where you can pick yourself up some new threads and help support what I'm doing at the same time. Please keep on telling your riding friends about the podcast, keep sharing the episodes on your social media, and generally just being awesome. If you've got time, then give us a review wherever it is you listen to the podcast. The reviews are super helpful. They're always nice to read, and it does help other people find the podcast. So if you've got a couple of minutes, please give us a review. All right, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon, but until then, get out and ride.